Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very excited about our sermon series coming up, as you can tell. I hope you get excited about it too. And I was noticing yesterday as I was pondering it, different subjects, we got the next three or four sermons kind of planned out, that as I was thinking about this sermon, I noticed that the fourth sermon was getting in, the third sermon. So it's hard to do that and to keep it straight. But I think the topic that we have been on to and will continue on is what does spiritual growth mean, and what does Unitarian Universalism mean, and how do we integrate spiritual growth and Unitarian Universalism? How does the history of Unitarian Universalism affect us in our spiritual growth and as individuals? And is it possible to kind of watch Unitarian Universalism history out here and like it and affirm it and say yes to it, but then if we watch it out here, then we don't step into it and participate with the history? And so we're also working on how do we participate and step into a historical line with intentionality to actualize the values that we believe in, rather than kind of stand out and not do that. And I thought I would give an example today of, in the beginning of this sermon, of how two worldviews collide and how you can participate in one worldview so much that you might not be able to really understand or appreciate somebody else's worldview. And so that would be a way of, in a way, we have to get out and look at it in order to step into it so we're not captured by it, so that we are, with intentionality and with intellect and with our hearts and spirit, we intentionally step into a heritage, a story, a history, rather than being captured by it. And this is an example of, I think, somebody captured by a worldview that they can't see another worldview. And it's important. How many of you know Patrick Buchanan? TV commentator guy, Nixon, Reagan, proclaimed libertarian, I suppose. He writes very honestly this article, and I'm surprised and glad of his position in a way, but the example of the worldviews colliding, it was just too good to let go. The article's called Tea Party versus War Party. First of all, for somebody to acknowledge that part of our political process has designated war party, I thought was pretty honest. This group of people are the war party people of our nation, is what he's saying. I thought that was pretty honest. And he's saying that the Tea Party and the War Party that makes up the Republican Party, which, wherever you stand, that's not the issue at this point, it's a worldview issue, that eventually they agree on deficit, getting rid of the deficit, right? They agree on that. But the war party of this Republican Party, they do not want to pull out of Iraq. They want permanent place in Iraq. They want permanent place in Afghanistan. And the Tea Party so much on deficit reduction, he's saying that eventually this is going to cause a split, because the Democrats aren't going to go along with the war party, but they will go along with some deficit reductions. Okay, and so he eventually says that the deficit's just way out of whack, and we've had hints 65 years ago, Eisenhower and different people warned us about being involved. George Washington warned us about being involved with other nations in terms of war. So, I mean, it's not a new theme. And so he eventually says that we got a choice to make. We're either going to maintain our empire or we're not. And he's saying that in order to maintain our empire, we're going to stay in deficit position. And the only way to get out of this deficit position is to end the empire, because the Democrats are not going to go along with cutting the social safety net, because the social safety net is the primary reason that Democrats exist. So they're not going to completely cut that out. So they're going to get, no, the war party, that part of the war, Republican war party and Democrats are never going to agree on anything. He said, but the Tea Party is so committed to deficit reduction, that the Tea Party and the Democratic Party might join up to pull the empire in. So here's Pat Buchanan saying, this is what we need to do. And I'm going, hey, okay, right? But then he says this, and this is where the worldviews come in. How many remember McGovern, 1968, run for president? He was running in 1968, was labeled the peace president. That's what he wanted, peace. Well, he did not win. And Buchanan says this about George McGovern, because George McGovern was bring them home. Bring them home from Vietnam. Bring them home. Let's not have these foreign wars. So he's the peace guy. And so at the end, Buchanan finally says that Senator McGovern was right. We have to bring them home. And he says the only problem with McGovern is that he was 40 years too early, was his timing. Okay? That's a worldview. What Buchanan is saying, for the past 40 years, my view has been completely right, and McGovern is just catching up with us. Right? That's his point. I'm right, and finally we're joining up with McGovern. Rather than McGovern was a prophet, he was right all along. If we would have done this in 1968, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today, and all those soldiers, both sides, people, civilians, wouldn't have died in Vietnam from 1968 on, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. So here you have, and I'm reading this, and I'm going, no, we should have joined McGovern in 1968 and pulled the troops home and started to end the empire then and commit to domestic strength. And that kind of. So here's two worldviews clashing. The same events, but two worldviews clashing. You have to be able to step. I mean, from this article, it seems like to me Buchanan didn't have the capacity just to step out and say, this is my worldview, this is McGovern's worldview, and here they are colliding. Maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong. Just a capacity to say, maybe I was right, or maybe I was wrong. The capacity to recognize that you do have a worldview, that you could be right and you could be wrong. I'm glad he's there. If we do not, if you've read Nemesis, Chalmers' book, he gives examples of the Roman Empire and the English Empire, where the Roman Empire stayed invested in imperialism and the Roman Empire ended, where the British Empire ended their imperialism, spent their money on domestic spending and strengthened their country. We do have examples of this. So, I'm glad he's there, 40 years late, and that's my worldview. He should have been a little faster. When we talk about spiritual growth in today's world, some of the images that come to my mind is when I've been down to visit Key West, and we walk into this one shop, and it has all the glass-made dolphins and kind of nice things, and it has a kind of the new age music, and it's just it almost takes your mind and moves you to a different mood where your whole body just goes and you kind of relax, and that gets labeled as spirituality. And when we let go of that tension, and somebody says if you practice that kind of that spiritual growth, and that's what we're about spiritually in today's culture. So when we think about spiritual growth that way, that's a good thing, and I think we also need that. But then when we think about spiritual growth in terms of our own heritage as Unitarian Universalists, we think about social justice, and when we think about spiritual growth in terms of social justice, it's a little bit different than walking into a New Age shop. When we think about the life of Jesus and social justice, which he was for social justice, and talking about making sure everybody had food and everybody had water and clothing, and that was primary part of his teachings, but he ended up executed. So here's spiritual growth that leads you there. When we think of Gandhi and his spiritual growth, he ends up assassinated. We think of Martin Luther King and exercising his spiritual maturity. So spiritual growth can be problematic, to say the least. So who would want spiritual growth that would lead us to isolation and that would lead us to be rejected? What is that about? And do I have the psychic capacity to mature my spiritual self in a culture that would reject? And as Unitarian Universalists, in a way, we kind of are rejected, called a cult. I mean, we've called many things, not even a church and such. So I thought I would kind of reset some principles of spiritual life as individuals and as a community as we begin this sermon series. One, so you know where I'm coming from. Two, so you can either agree or argue with me, or agree and say, and here's more stuff too that we need to consider as well. So those kind of things, and then we'll move on to Channing. When you look at an infant, and part of Channing's work, William Ellery Channing, one of the founders of Unitarianism in this country in the 1810, 1820, 30s, when you look at his work and what he teaches, he uses the word unfolding a lot. He says that our spirituality and who we are as beings unfolds, and ideally in a nice gradual pace and kind of way. And he doesn't really mention disruptions or anger or violence. He just says there's a nice, graceful unfolding process in our spirituality, and we move toward the sense of the infinite and to the light. When we look at how we deal with children in our culture and children developmentally, there's thinking that also goes along with that. That you take a child and you hold a child and you gradually introduce that child to the world. You gradually introduce that child to more and more and more of the world, so that the child, in a way, senses being cared for, senses being loved, and that as the child integrates the world, the larger world, more and more and more, the child's always in touch with the sense of being loved and cared for. The sense of being loved and cared for accompanies being introduced to the larger world, and that child's life will unfold and unfold and unfold in a very graceful way. And I would also say that that's the kind of experience that we need to be able to carry out the spiritual growth that was modeled by Jesus, Gandhi, and King. We need that in us, that sense of being cared for, that sense of being loved, that sense of being held. We need that in us to move to that spiritual maturity. And so as that happens with the child, that also needs to happen for us as a community. As a community, you need to be able to come here and have different thoughts and explore different thoughts and have different experiences and share your story and know that as you do that, you are cared for. That needs to happen here. That sense of emotional safety needs to happen here. And if it doesn't happen here, we're not going to be social justice active. We're not going to do that part of our work, because if we don't feel that sense of safety and cared for, we're not going to do it in a way that makes sense. I like how Julian of Norwich, she wrote, 1500, 1400, do you remember? Something like that. And she lived in this convent and lived in this little room and meditated about her relationship with God. And she has this to say about her relationship with God. And the person talking about her writes, Religion is an environment. And how do we create this environment that's going to be religion? It says it's provided by a God or a sense of being loved and cared for who holds us in being. So the first question would be, do we allow ourselves to be cared for? Do we allow ourselves to be loved? Do we allow ourselves to be held in being? And a simple way to get at that is when somebody gives you a compliment, do you say, oh no, it was nothing? You know, I mean, do you brush away the warmth people give you? People say something kind about you. In the Joys and Sorrows, somebody said something about me that sermons are spiritual, you know, and my initial reaction was, oh, no, now what? So, you know, the expectations of me and all that kind of stuff. And you see, I didn't, in a way, I caught myself. I put up a wall rather than feel the warmth of what was being said. I said, here, I'm going to do that in a sermon. I'm doing it right here. I couldn't believe it. But we do. We put up walls and we block the warmth from others that comes to us. And what this woman is saying is that if we're in a community, do we allow ourselves to be held? Do we allow ourselves to be cared for? The religious environment is healing to humans because in each human infancy and childhood has inevitably included gaps that have led to the faltering, to the falter in their child's, how do you say the word, reconnecting? No.
Reconnoitering.
Reconnoitering. And I looked at that word, I said, new word for me. New word, look it up. And what they're saying is that the child has to be able to go and explore and gain new knowledge with a sense of safety. And that the adults watch and make sure that the safety's there. That includes picking up the book Catcher in the Rye. That includes picking up the books that want to be banned. That includes anything that would bring knowledge to that child. If that child feels cared for and secure, the knowledge that comes into that child's world will be handled okay. It won't sweep the child away. It always amazed me when any particular church would get all upset about a movie, like The Last Temptation of Christ or whatever, or get upset about a book. And I always thought to myself, if a movie or a book would shake my faith, then my faith needs to be shaken. Because that ought not to be so. If I'm grounded in who I am as a human being and I'm grounded in who I am with my religious sensibilities, I ought to be available for conversation, but not to be shaken with protest. So too, just as the child explores and gains new knowledge, our church ought to be the same. We ought to be able to explore and gain new knowledge and bring it into the church body for conversation and for dialogue. I ought to be able to talk about, well, maybe Buchanan's view's right. Maybe from 68 from now, the country needed to go that way. I don't, until I look at it and understand it, I don't know. Maybe my worldview is wrong. Here comes new information. Julian of Norwich puts it this way. God, love, knits humans into a divine being. I love this word. Wanting them. O-N-E-I-N-G. Wanting them into God's being, into the sense of oneness with the feeling of love for one another. Likened to a mother, God stays with humans through all their ruthless attacks, surviving these attacks out of her own resilience and remaining empathetic. Mothering is mothering us into one whole person living through her shared experience with us. I dare say if that theology governed every church in this country, we would have a different country. If every church in this country had the idea that it's a mothering process and healing human beings from their woundedness, this would be a different country. And when some people have said to me, when I tell them that I'm a Unitarian Universalist and they say this is not a church, what they're saying is, you're not a church like our church. That's what they're saying. And I'm going, you're right. You're right. We would never have, as long as I'm here, unless you'd force me to in some way, we would never have a screen come down from our ceiling on a Sunday morning with senators on it talking to us about legislation. We would never have that. 25,000 churches in this country did do that. So we are different. And we ought to say that we are different. And I'm going to say what Julian of Norwich said, that the churches need to be a oneing process where we become one and we nurture and we care for one another. For me, that is the vision for our church. That is who we are. That is what we become. And it is only out of that kind of vision that we can do social justice that will have a kindness to it and energy to it that where you know, think about the dividedness of our country and the hate and the words and even when things I like happen and I watch people's responses and I cringe and somebody got fired, a TV pundit said something mean about somebody else and it was so mean they fired them, and then TV pundits, if I have to like some, the ones I liked, shamed and made fun of. And it's just like on and on. The shaming, the critical, the hate. We're just bombarded with it. And how do we build this church where we have walls of love and care, like a force field, I guess, that when that kind of stuff comes, we can leave it out there and find some breath here that's clean, that's healthy, that's good. I like this vision of the church mothering us to wanting, to being one, to being whole, to being healthy. Then she says, in the absence of this, mothering, wholeness, uniting, knitting, weaving us together with an attitude of care, with an attitude of love, in the absence of this, we will feel entitled to act out against others who do not accept the reality of our beliefs. We will discard those who reject symbols that are meaningful to us as enemies of society, as groups to be discriminated against, even persecuted. Now, how do we get that kind of attitude in this church? How do we really build it so that we can actualize those kind of feelings in our church? And what Winnicott teaches, what Channing teaches us, is that we humans have this capacity to reflect, to make meaning, to form our internal lives. And he says that it is our responsibility to do that. I almost was thinking about how, as Unitarians, we usually don't take teachings from history and say you've got to conform to the teachings of history or you're going to go into a place and burn forever. We can't do that. Either you wouldn't come back or you know I was joking or something. So we don't take teachings from history and impose them with force and fear. We don't do that. Probably why we're small. That we don't do that. But if I could do that, with this teaching from history, I would do it. And here's why I would do it. Winnicott said that Channing says that this is the key to human dignity, this is the key to nobility, this is the key to kindness, and ultimately this is the key to social justice. That we have this capacity to form and reform and let go of old beliefs and let go of old authorities and create new authorities for ourselves. When After World War II, people were trying to understand how was it that a nation that normal, we would consider normal, average, everyday people in a nation do such horrific things or be passive while they knew horrific things were going on in World War II in the Holocaust and genocide and just mass murder. How was it? One of the authorities, Hannah Arendt, who wrote about and made the term the banality of evil, evil being ordinary. A society created, a society evolved in which evil became ordinary. And so the question was, how? How did that happen? And this is her conclusion after studying that and writing about it and taking a couple of people and looking at their lives. In a report of the banality of evil, she proposed that a lack of critical thinking and reflection allows for the propagation of evil acts. Studies of group psychology frequently show processes like a lack of critical thinking and reflection involved in otherwise inexplicable and harmful behavior of groups of people. By not, as Channing teaches, by not reflecting, making meaning, transforming yourself, by not doing that spiritual practice, we are vulnerable. We are vulnerable as people, as human beings, to be manipulated into doing things we would not ordinarily do. We protect ourselves by reflecting and meaning-making and transforming ourselves and being involved in that kind of spiritual practice. If we don't, then who are we to become? If we don't take this spiritual practice, this human exercising this innate human capacity, the gift that we have to reflect on our history and to reflect on history as a whole, the best that we can understand it, and engage ourselves in dialogue with that history, in order to transform ourselves and to learn to know how to be a better people, to know how to be a better person, to know that when words are coming toward me, I say, no, those are the same words that were spoken in 1943 by this particular person that are being spoken today, so I can say, that's a story I don't want to be involved in. I don't want to be involved in that story. As a matter of fact, I'm going to rise up and speak against that story because I know it's connected to history. If I don't know that, I might hear these words and say, yeah, that's right. And join with the group of people that 3 years later say, my God, how did I get involved in that? So if I could take Channing's words and say, this is gospel. His words on this issue are gospel. That we have the capacity to transform ourselves, not to be conformed. And as he says, and as I say, it is our responsibility, not as Unitarian Universalists, it is our responsibility as human beings to exercise that capacity to engage our society in better practices.